on this week's episode of TechSnap, a disastrous fire strikes a major data player, and then we'll explain what island hopping is and how attackers can use it to exploit a network. Then it's a great big batch of your questions, a rockin' roundup, and much, much more on this week's episode of TechSnap. Everyone, and welcome to TechSnap. This is episode 149 of Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly Systems Network and Administration Podcast. We streamed this episode live on February 6th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by our three fine sponsors, GoDaddy, Ting, and iX Systems. I'll tell you more about those great sponsors as the show goes on. Our live stream, it's powered by the incredible Scale Engine over at scaleengine.com. You got to go check that out. My name is Chris, and joining us every single week is our host, the admin, the tech, and the teacher, Mr. Alan Jude. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Chris, everybody.
Hi, Alan. Good to have you back. Now, we're doing a double TechSnap today, and have you told anybody why we're pre-recording?
I think we mentioned a couple times. I'm having some wisdom teeth out.
Yeah, like some
fun stuff.
Yeah, and you're also pre-recording BSD Now as well.
Yes, so I guess by the time you see this, that'll be done, though.
Yeah. So
if you're watching live right now, it'll be on Monday at starting half hour early.
Right after Coda Radio.
And we'll have a live interview with Chris Buchler from PSense.
Oh, good one.
And then a PSense overview tutorial thing.
So is that going to be 23, I think?
Yep, that'll be 23.
Yeah. So you guys can go check that out on demand, too, if you'd like.
Or no, is it 24?
It's right in that range. I'm sure the title will tell.
I think it's 24 because okay. I'm pretty sure 23 was the one we recorded yesterday.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds right. When you do shows back to back and close together, it all kind of gets a little blurry.
Yeah. It'll be 24 because 23 was yesterday, which is uploaded and ready for you to edit when you get time.
Right on. Right on. Well, so speaking of things that can kind of knock you out of the game for a little bit, a fire can really knock you out of the game. And now we're seeing a story that shows us that even some of the best, the top in the industry, are not invulnerable to this kind of thing. What's going on, Alan? Yep.
So there was a fire at the Iron Mountain Data Warehouse in Buenos Aires, which is in Argentina.
Argentina!
Every one of them. Anyway, although it's unclear how the fire started, it apparently spread very quickly and took hours to get under control. 9 first responders were killed during the blaze.
Oh my gosh.
Really high. And there are 2 that are still missing and 7 others that were injured.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that seems highly unusual.
Must have been a hell of a fire.
Yeah. By the time the fire was put out, the building appeared to be ruined, according to news reports.
Wow.
Yeah. Interestingly, among the data stored at the warehouse, apparently, were several archives containing corporate and central bank records.
Of course.
Potentially a huge loss that could have some unexpected, far-reaching consequences. Specifically, just last month, the United States Supreme Court decided to hear a case on whether creditors could seek historic bank records from Argentina regarding the country's debt default in 2001. Whether or not such files have now been destroyed is unknown, which adds a whole level of conspiracy theory to the whole thing.
I was just going to say, if you want to get a little out there, you could claim maybe the fire was started on purpose.
Yeah. The Buenos Aires facility apparently was supposed to have its own team of private firefighters, which might suggest that they didn't trust the public system fire department. Well, I don't know what the infrastructure is like
there. If your business is saving records, maybe you just need the response of somebody on site all the time.
Right. And, you know, that's not uncommon. Like here, when I worked at the power plant had its own fire department. And the steel mill across the road had its own fire department. And the oil refinery over there had its own fire department.
Right, all
and
next to each other.
Had cooperation agreements so if there was fire at one place, the fire departments from the other two would come over and help as well. Plus, they would call the actual fire department to come as well if, you know, it was more than just a small incident or whatever.
Sure.
Especially because, you know, with an oil refinery, the level of hazmat stuff you can get into gets pretty crazy. And so maybe they need extra special training and things like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it could be.
And, you know, that could apply to a records warehouse like this as well, because, you know, if you're dealing with Halon or something like that, that's different type of things. That's although apparently they didn't have that. But anyway, so they're supposed to have this team of private fire department firefighters. It's not clear if they actually did or not, or how that affected anything. There's very few details so far. There's also supposed to have been a sprinkler system and an automatic containment mechanism designed to stop fires from spreading to different parts of the building. But if, as we've been reported, the entire building was burned down, it seems that didn't work either, or was unable to contain it.
How much do you worry about? You have servers and data centers all over the world. How much do you worry about fire?
Not so much, because most of those servers are specifically designed so that they can just be thrown away, where it doesn't matter if they get destroyed or break or whatever, right? That's part of our system.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do have some data that we have to replicate, and, you know, we make sure it's in more than one location. And part of that is the reason why we're getting a fancy fiber line to my house, is to make that disaster recovery cheaper by doing a dedicated line instead of doing it over the internet.
See, what I worry about is Jupiter Broadcasting has assets that are so large that it's not practical for me to store them off-site, and I can't move them very quickly, even with a 50 megabit Fios connection. So right. I have a lot of stuff that if there was a fire here at the house, I would lose forever. I mean, like my wife's photos and things like that, those are backed up to an off-site service because that's reasonable. But, you know, I'm talking 13, 14 terabytes worth of data. I can't send that to CrashPlan.
If you can afford the extra hard drives, you could have the replica at your studio, right? Where you just
I think that's what I'll do.
Drives back and forth, every once in a while.
I think that's what I'll try to whittle it down to the absolute most, you know, can't lose assets, and then move that in between locations.
Yeah, but whenever it's a manual process, it never gets done often enough.
It's true. Yeah.
Yep. With the amount you generate, even a trickle stream wouldn't be good enough, right?
Right. I mean, just look at
even
this
if
episode,
you could
right?
upload a megabit a second from location to location,
it's not enough. The
amount you do shows, that's probably not enough.
And that's a Today Show production level. And if by the end of 2014 we have, you know, more shows,
even more shows,
it's even more. Yeah. The problem just compounds itself.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, it might. Yeah. Yeah, that's some interesting problems.
Chatroom says, by the way, the TechSnap show is live every single Thursday except for this week over at jblive.tv at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is
4 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC.
And we have a live chat room, and they say, Chris, it's not the data that's that big. It's just your jacket. So maybe
well,
if I see
a bunch of people, a pump, bunch of people suggesting BitTorrent sync.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
I already
how is that going to help? Because you still have to upload the 50 gigabyte raw footage of TechSnap.
I had a client that I was, they would dial into the studio, and I would record everything locally in ProRes. ProRes is a lossless file. It's kind of like FLAC for audio. So you can figure when you're doing HD video, you know, it gets quite big. And I would BitTorrent sync it to them in New York. And it would take two or more days because on their end, they only had like, I think it was like 10 megabits down. And so I'm sending to them as fast as I can send it, but it doesn't matter what we obviously couldn't use something like Dropbox because one episode would fill the Dropbox. So BitTorrent sync was perfect, but you're still limited by upload and download speeds on both ends.
Right, because, you know, if it takes you 2 days to send over the copy of TechSnap, well, the show you do on Friday, that means it's not going to get sent till like Monday.
Yeah.
And the show you do on Monday would then be pushed back to like Thursday.
And really?
All of a sudden, you're behind.
We kind of cheat a little bit, quote-unquote cheat, with BSD Now in the sense that you record it there on the East Coast, and you store it to a very high-resolution, high-megabit H.264 file, and then I download that, so it's way smaller than the ProRes. But if we could,
it'd
be nice to have it lossless.
4 hours to upload.
Yeah.
And when I get the fatter connection here, I'm looking at doing slightly higher resolution, which will be nice.
Yeah. Whoop, whoop. So I feel their pain. You know, this is a hard problem to solve.
Yeah, I'm but you know, you like it. Having the ProRes files because if you ever need to go back and do something, they're so much better.
And
but
the
maybe
editing
for archival, you'll have to do kind of like I do with BSD Now, or maybe just do like a double the bitrate I do BSD Now. You still have a lot of the quality left.
Yeah, yeah, and you know,
and the tools are getting better at working with raw H.264 files. Right before ProRes, you had to have because trying to import H.264 was impossible, and now it's not so bad.
That's been a change that's come in the last couple of years thanks to GPU accelerated editing, and it helps a lot. And so I'm looking at what I kind of I've been thinking along those lines, but I almost want like to have a machine that's not part of the regular production pipeline dedicated to it. So et cetera, et cetera.
But well, yes, if you have to convert 6 years back catalog, then you have to do that almost.
Yeah.
And can you afford another machine to do all that?
Yeah, not really.
Although it doesn't have to be very fast.
Tape backup. There you go.
Well, he wouldn't have to mail it if he has to. If he's going to his studio most days of the week anyway, he can just haul stuff. But I don't know that tapes are really that much bigger than hard drives.
You know what
anymore.
I need is like a self-powered computer in my car. Right. Okay. Connected to the Wi-Fi that just automatically syncs using BitTorrent sync to the hard drive in my
car. Your problem is the Wi-Fi is too slow for that.
Oh, you're right. Dang it. Oh, dang it. You're right.
Like gigabit Ethernet is barely fast enough for this stuff.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. Yeah, I transfer at 101 or so megabytes, and that's still the slowest part for editing.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, is it, people are saying Amazon Glacier, but again, same problem. You have to upload it to the internet and be able to download it when you get it back. And it's just crazy.
Well, Alan, any other thoughts on this particular story?
Yeah, there was a couple other things. Okay. According to local reports, it appears the storage facility this occurred at was primarily used for physically storing paper records, not digital data. So that answers the first question of why wasn't this data just replicated? You know, like if it's a data center, they should have been able to flip over to Hotspur and have like no downtime.
Mm.
You know, fire is a big financial loss and a big occurrence, but it shouldn't have put any records at risk.
Right.
Because that's the whole point of paying a company like Iron Mountain to do this stuff. But at the same time, Iron Mountain has yet to release any further statements on the issue. So it's unclear whether there were digital copies of these records, right? If they had scanned them or something, or if there were backup copies, right? Because even if you have paper records, or especially if you have paper records in some cases, it's important to have backups, whether those are digitized or if it's like, you know, photocopies of the records and storing them offsite somewhere. But it also might explain why the fire was so intense if it's just a building full of paper.
Yeah, that's going to burn pretty good.
Yep.
Absolutely.
But it'd be interesting to see a postmortem on why the containment systems didn't stop it and why the sprinkler system didn't prevent the fire from getting out of control. And
the local, you know, fire.
What it was that might have caused so many firefighters to be killed. It might have just been, you know, a roof collapse or something, and it wasn't necessarily something wrong, or it could have been something bad design or something.
That's the tragic part of this story, isn't it?
Yep. You know, when you hear about mass data loss, it's sad, but when you hear that 9 people died, or maybe as many as 11, that's a big deal.
It is. Yeah, it's sad. And it also is a reminder to all of us that you got to kind of think about these things, because even people who you would think would be tremendously prepared and potentially even go out of their way to be ready for this kind of thing can still be affected by it. So yep. We all have to take precautions. All right, Alan. Well, why don't I take a minute here and thank our sponsor, GoDaddy.com, who's got the $295.com deal. Bringing it back, everybody. I know. Strike while the iron is hot, because I think it's only going to be active for a few weeks. And here's how you take advantage of it. When you're over at GoDaddy.com, put a .com in your shopping cart and then use the promo code 295TECH. When you check out, 295TECH will get you that .com for $2.95. And I believe you still get like a great deal on all the additional .coms. You get like a discount and on multiple years too. So this is a really great offer all around. $295 tech when you check out over at GoDaddy.com. Of course, GoDaddy is the world's number one domain name registrar. And there is a very good reason for that. When you go somewhere that doesn't use GoDaddy, I've seen this as a contractor so many times. It is this moment you go, oh, crap. Oh, shoot. This is going to be a process. Things get lost. Things are just never as simple as when they're over at GoDaddy. Plus, GoDaddy is great when you're working with teams or businesses. If you have clients or if you're just part of a company that maybe will eventually have some turnover, there's all kinds of security things you can do to make working in a team in a group environment much easier and much more straightforward and much more secure. So use the promo code 295TECH when you check out over at GoDaddy.com and get a .com for $2.95. Now is the time. Use this to forward a URL that's crazy long. Like, you know, we have jbtitles.com. I use the GoDaddy 295 code to make jbtitles.com forward to a much longer URL. And what's great is the GoDaddy management dashboard makes forwarding URLs really easy. And you can do masking. You can set it as a permanent or a temporary redirect. It is really simple to do. You just go right in your domain management, set it up, and it makes a 295.com super useful. And by the way, if you got a couple of .coms in your GoDaddy account that you don't have pointed at an active server, go in there and just set them forward to a domain you are using. Or if you want to support the Jupiter Broadcasting Network, have it forward to jupiterbroadcasting.com. Lots of ways to take advantage of that. So go use the promo code 295TECH when you check out. And a big thank you to GoDaddy for sponsoring the TechSnap program. Okay, Alan. Moving to our next story, I hate the concept of DRM creeping further into our lives, and I have a feeling this story kind of takes us down that path, doesn't it?
Well, the article attempts to skip over the usual arguments about DRM.
Oh, good.
Copyright versus fair use and morality and is it stealing and all this other stuff.
Right.
And just looking at, despite all the plans about what DRM is supposed to be and what's wrong with it and all this, how's it actually working in the real world? And, you know, what problems have we come up that are actually happening? And where is it different than what everybody thought was going to happen?
Right, all the warnings or whatnot.
Yeah. So instead, it focuses on what actually happens in the real world.
Okay.
So the only reason most DRM works at all is because of the legal protection it gets from the government, right? If there was a, you know, DRM that says you can't read your ebooks on Wednesday, but there was an, you know, you could buy a different ebook reader that would read your ebooks and just ignore the DRM, everybody would buy that ebook reader, right? But breaking DRM is against the law now because of laws like the DMCA. And the biggest problem with it is that DRM is fundamentally technically flawed, right? It relies on encrypting data, the valuable data, but somehow giving the keys to the attacker so that they can decrypt the data and use it, but only under the circumstances you want them to be able to. And, you know, that basically relies on either you controlling the device and not allowing the end user, who's often in their parlance, the attacker, to be able to tell what's going on. So a good analogy for this is inkjet printers, right? Printer companies make a lot more money when you buy the ink from them than when you buy a refill kit. So they do a bunch of stuff to stop you from refilling your cartridges, right? Like, you know, the ink cartridges that have intelligence and know how much has been used and try to stop working when you refill them. You know, like there were some HP cartridges that would, or Epson was really bad for making cartridges that had a chip in them and they would try to stop working if you refilled them.
I remember that. In fact, they still do that, don't they?
I think so, yes. Nevertheless, you can easily and legally buy cheap refilled or third-party cartridges for your printer. Right? And this is the same thing that would happen with DRM if it wasn't for laws like the DMCA that stop you from, or stop people from reverse engineering the DRM and publishing the results.
Yeah.
And the other problem is that the same laws have got pushed out into other countries with through the World Trade Organization and so forth.
Right. Sort of what kind of starts as U.S. company concepts make it out through trade agreements to the rest of the nations.
Right. The way it all started was the copyright czar, who used to work for Microsoft, came up with this idea where every time information was copied, it would have to check for authorization. Like literally copying the memory from the disk into RAM and then from RAM to the video card, each time it would have to stop and have checked for a license on it or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was just ridiculous. People that don't understand how computers work try to do stuff.
Yeah.
And so when that law tried to be attached to the effort to demilitarize the internet, it was blocked, being like, no, that's just horrible and bad. No, we're not doing that. So instead, the guy went and pushed it through the trade organizations and got it into U.S. law in a roundabout way instead, and forced countries like Canada and the UK and everywhere to adopt similar things.
Yeah.
Anyway, the article goes on with some really interesting quotes like, here's another thing about security. It's a process, not a product.
Amen to that.
Bruce Schneier there. But it gets down to where DRM and your security are at cross purposes. Right, the DMCA injunction against publishing weaknesses in DRM means that it's vulnerable and those vulnerabilities remain unpatched for longer than if it was a system that wasn't being protected from reverse engineering by the DMCA. So that means that any system with DRM will on average be more dangerous to its users than one that doesn't have DRM. Right, because they're stopping people from reverse engineering it or publishing information about how it works.
Yeah.
You know, various large and respected security organizations say that they knew about the Sony rootkit. You remember that one from 2006?
Oh, yeah.
Months before it was disclosed, but didn't want to publish because they feared they would be punished under the DMCA. Mm. Right? It's got this, you know, the chilling effect of the DMCA. But there's no real world, real security in the world where it is illegal to tell people when the computers in their lives are putting them in danger. Right? In other words, they have no real security in the world where the DMCA and its global cousins are still intact. Because for DRM to work, the computer has to be able to do stuff without you being able to stop it do that. And if it's your computer, you don't want it to do that.
Yeah.
Right? That was the Sony rootkit. What it did was it hid any file that started with $sys$. And as soon as anybody found out about that, every malware author started naming their files like that. So anybody with the Sony rootkit would all of a sudden not even be able to see the malware files or that they were running.
Yeah.
Because DRM requires some way to stop you from telling that a process is running and stopping you from doing what you want to do. Because if you can see it, you can kill it. So the closing quote that I like here was, you see, contrary to what the judge said in the Meredes case in 2000, which was that, you know, one of the challenges against the DMCA and saying it's not about whether or not information is free, but whether or not people are free, right? There's basically conflicting rulings. In, I think, 97, Daniel Bernstein won a case against the government to be able to publish code for cryptography, right? Because the NSA was trying to class that as munitions and that you weren't allowed to export it to foreign countries and right. So on.
Yep.
Well, so he won this legal victory saying that code is protected free speech. But then in this other case in 2000, the judge ruled that, you know, the DRM code and exploits about it and information about it were not protected by free speech because it was about hackers who thought that information should be free for anybody who's smart enough to break DRM. And that's obviously not what the case was actually about. It seems the judge had made up his mind before anything started.
Yeah.
And so it'd be nice to see a new challenge against that, but nobody's willing to take the risk because a second ruling on the side of DRM might make things worse. But anyway, it's a interesting article, and I recommend people go and read it and think about it in a new way. It's like, you know, DRM is a giant pain in the butt. You know, it's like, oh, so I bought these books on iTunes, and now I can't read them on my Kindle or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it's more about, you know, using something with DRM that works means that somebody else controls the computer you're using, not you.
You know, you made a good point there where you said for DRM, DRM really kind of relies on the backing of governments for it to actually function. And I'm thinking of Android ROMs and how we keep going back and forth, is rooting and ROMing your device a violation of the DMCA when you break whatever it is you're breaking to be able to do that, to get around their locked bootloader.
The protection that they lock in the bootloader or whatever.
And so, you know, one of my whipping boys is the fact that all of these old Android devices are walking around out there that are running old versions of Linux, and they are connected to a network that is, I mean, they have an open data connection constantly. And I always am thinking this is such a, I mean, these are old implementations of Bluetooth, these are old web browsers that are on these things, they're just not getting updated anymore. And there's a perfectly legitimate reason to want to root and ROM your device to replace that old version that HTC shipped on there 3 years ago with some, maybe there's some Cyanogen mod or some project out there that's delivering an updated patched version of Android that works on that device. That's a perfectly legitimate reason to want to root and ROM your device to stay secure. But technically, it's a violation. It's breaking the DRM, and you can get in trouble for it. And we've gone back and forth in the U.S., and I think recently it's now considered again a DMCA violation, even after a temporary suspense of that. And that keeps people from staying safe.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Alan, why don't we take a break right here and thank our second sponsor this week. This is the great folks over at IX Systems. Go to ixsystems.com/TechSnap, because that's where you want to go to let them know you heard about them here on the TechSnap program and you appreciate them. Alan's rocking his IX Systems t-shirt. I got one of those. I was just wearing it over the weekend, too.
Oh, cool.
Super comfortable. So, listen, if you go over to ixsystems.com/TechSnap, right there on the landing page, they have the ultimate guide to buying a server for open source. Put your name and your email address in there. They're not going to spam you. They're just going to give you the white paper that they had written up by a third party and tells you how to integrate some of that stuff. Now, Alan, why do you choose IX Systems for your servers over at Scale Engine?
Because we trust the Intel processors and we love the IX burn-in system where they make sure the server is going to work perfectly when we get it.
Yeah, that's a great reason right there, isn't it? And I tell you, they have a whole wide range. So Alan's got the big dog systems that are actually meant for big production.
I have little ones too.
Yeah, you do. Actually, like that router is really cool.
Yeah, like the router I'm using right now is a little short depth 1U machine I bought from my ex. And, you know, it's like I need something small and cheap. And then, you know, after that, I came back. It's like, all right, I need something about yay big that holds like 36 4 terabyte drives. And I know dual ported controllers and, you know.
Yeah, you wanted to
sell me some big iron.
Well, I've been really happy with the FreeNAS Mini that I got. And it's not quite as fancy as anything like that. But it is, it's actually really great. It's got 4 hot swappable drives built into the front of it. I've never actually tempted to pull them out hot, but I mean like they're removables. They've got a recovery system on that thing. I think mine has an i5 processor in it and 12 gigabytes of RAM. It's awesome. It runs 24/7. It's got FreeNAS just ready to go on it. It's really cool, and it also supports a lot of other operating systems, like all of their gear. And now, one of the things you've mentioned before, and I don't think we've mentioned it since iX Systems is back on the show, but they kind of have a special setup with their hardware partner, too. This maybe, you know, gives them a little bit of an advantage, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, they're actually across the road from Supermicro, the guys that build the...
It's so awesome.
...design the motherboards and stuff.
It's genius.
And so, they also have very close relationships with LSI and Western Digital. Currently... there's a new set of LSI RAID cards coming out, and the driver for FreeBSD isn't finished yet. But if you're using the beta of FreeNAS, you can try out the driver that they're working in cooperation with LSI to design for FreeBSD.
You know, and not only that, so not only do they have these amazing hardware partnerships, and I mean, we're talking about intimate connections with these hardware vendors, they also have an incredibly deep bench of folks from the open source and BSD communities who are literally the creators or experts in those fields. They're in often cases, they're the people that invented the technologies that we all rely upon. If you could not assemble a better company to be a hardware vendor like this, especially if you need open source hardware and if you're a fan of the Intel server platform, it is the perfect accumulation of expertise, hardware relationships, know-how, and open source technology. It's amazing. And I want you to go find out more, especially if you're considering doing something for your data center. Go over to ixsystems.com/techsnap. Try out that white paper too. And you see why we've just been raving about iX Systems now for quite a while. And they're also great supporters of the BSD Now program. And hope to see them at Linux Fest Northwest this year.
Yep.
Okay, Alan, where did we go next on our journey into the TechSnap news?
Talking about defense contractors.
Yeah, a story about... do you think this came from a company that kind of has some skin in the game? It seems like this was framed in a post-Snowden contractors aren't trustworthy context.
A little bit, but partly I think is this company trying to sell stuff to defense contractors and also to maybe make their to start a push towards some cybersecurity stuff.
It's interesting insights regardless.
Yes. So ThreatTrack Security Defense Contractor did a survey of defense contractors on the kind of unique population of IT managers and staffers who are responsible for securing networks for organizations that fulfill defense contracts. Mm-hmm. 1/4 of those polled for organizations with IT security budgets of $1 million to $10 million.
Oh.
And another 23% had budgets over $10 million for IT.
Nice. So these are some big money players.
88% believe the government provides adequate guidance and support to contractors to ensure sensitive data is secure and protected against cyber attacks. So, you know, when the government knows about specific types of attacks, they tell the contractors. Despite the high level of confidence regarding the government's guidance, almost 2/3, 62% of IT managers polled worry that their company is vulnerable to targeted attacks from malware. Hmm. And, you know, we see this, it could be as simple as a secretary falling for a phishing scam, right? And then they're inside your network and all over the place. Or they could get into your air conditioning system.
Your HVAC, like we've recently talked about. Yeah, and we're going to, in the feedback segment, I think we're going to have a little discussion about island hopping too. And it's this exact thing what you're talking about.
Yeah, but the survey uncovered sharp differences in security attitudes and practices between defense contractors and just the general enterprise IT community. For instance, senior leaders within defense contractors are far less frequently engaged in risky behavior, like opening phishing emails, lending work computers to family members, and using company-owned PCs to visit pornographic websites that harbor malware. So you kind of expect that, although you could expect that from everyone, right? It's a work laptop. Don't use it for things other than work. But, you know, it's nice to see at least some people taking some of the security stuff seriously. Although their level of anxiety over vulnerabilities to cybercrime isn't too different, 62% among defense contractors and 68% in enterprise, the reasons why they're worried differ. Right? Enterprise executives say they fear a lack of adequate protection, while contractors worry more that the frequency and complexity of the malware attacks. Right? Enterprises are still thinking about antivirus, whereas the defense contractors are worried about, you know, explicit advanced persistent threats against them that no virus scanner is going to be able to find.
Well, and fighting those,
it's brand new.
And fighting those is what makes them the most money too.
Yeah.
As contractors.
Well, as a defense contractor, they don't make any money, but defending themselves against
defending
the Chinese
themselves.
Trying to steal the planes for the F-35.
I mean, if you're a defense contractor who's selling cybersecurity services, you make the most money. So you'd be thinking about those too.
Right. But in this case, it's more, you know, you're at big risk if you're the person that exposes the secret. And so they worry about that. The survey also found contractors take more precautions against cyber attacks than the general enterprise counterparts, which is at least a positive discovery. You would expect them to, although you would expect the general audience to take it a little more seriously as well. Asked about the most difficult aspect of defending organizations from advanced malware, 61% of respondents cited the volume of attacks, right? If you're being attacked constantly, it means it's a lot harder to keep up. And 59% pointed to malware complexity, right? The malware is getting a lot smarter, and so are the authors. You know, when the malware can be in a printer, it's a lot harder to defend against with your desktop antivirus.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people concerned about other aspects drops dramatically, with 34% blaming the ineffectiveness of anti-malware tools, because if you understand how the tools work, you understand that there's not much they can do, and 29% saying they don't have enough budget for the right tools. Part of it, I'd say, is also it's got to come down to more training. And as far as malware goes, almost all of your exposure comes from the weakest links, right? The lowest paid people in the company that have the most menial jobs are the ones that are going to fall for the phishing scam, right?
Or sometimes
the secretary who doesn't have the IT training that everybody in the IT department does.
Sometimes it's also at the very top, the CEO, yes. Right? Who's not?
Yeah, it's the less technically sophisticated users are usually your weak point. Not always, but usually.
Yeah, for sure.
More than a quarter of respondents said their staffs don't have enough highly skilled IT security experts, including malware analysts. Now, a defense contractor is one of the few places other than like an antivirus company where you'd expect to actually have malware analysts on staff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one person can't really be an expert at every type of malware. So you almost think that you kind of need some kind of partnership with some place like Kaspersky to deal with the malware, because you can't possibly contain all that expertise in your own team. But obviously with Kaspersky being Russian, there's, you know, American defense contractors can't necessarily go to them directly. You might have to find some other firm.
True.
But if you can't go to the best firm for the job, then you're kind of hamstrung in that way too, right?
Mm.
And because of considerations like that, oftentimes the defense contractors are going to have their own analysts instead. Based on the survey's finding, the Snowden affair has had a profound impact on how defense contractors hire and train employees who handle sensitive information, right? Because they don't want to be the next company to cause a Snowden.
Sure.
The Snowden leaks have caused contractors to restrict IT administrative rights much more readily instead of giving everybody admin rights, and be more alert about any potential misbehavior by employees accessing secure data. I wonder if they're reconsidering the company they hire for background checks as well.
No, I hope.
Yep. 55% of respondents said employees now get more cybersecurity awareness training. 52% said they have reviewed and or reevaluated employee data access privileges, which seems remarkably low. And 47% said they have they're on higher alert for potential misbehavior or anomalous network activity. But, you know, if you're looking at network activity by hand, you're not going to find it before you're after the fact.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In addition, 41% said they've implemented stricter hiring practices, and 39% have curtailed IT administrative rights. Respondents who said nothing has changed were in the minority with nearly 23%.
Ah. I'm really torn on this particular issue because as a contractor, I know that I've had access to more than I should. I've retained more access than I should after I've left. And it's always been dependent on me to just be a good human and not break the rules. However, at the same time, I feel like we're starting to blame the contractor more than we should for this kind of stuff. There was a news story that just came out recently about a security lapse, and of course, instantly, you blame the contractor. At the Super Bowl, that Wi-Fi password we talked about last week, they blamed it on a contractor.
Right.
So it's one of these things where the benefit to contractors is they oftentimes can be higher skilled than the actual government workers can or even a company's workers can because these contractors focus, hyper-focus on security. They hyper-focus on whatever their individual, you know, data management, whatever their particular expertise is. And they really are rock stars at that. And they wouldn't want to work at a 9-to-5 company because it's not challenging enough for them to do the day-to-day stuff. And so you have to rely on that kind of setup with a contract company who can have a rock star like that and bring them in
right.
for a few months that you need them. There's really, I don't see another way to do it. But at the same time, it seems to be this impossible human gap you have to cover to improve security for contractors, because at the end of the day, good contractor security, keeping things confidential, keeping their access locked down, keeping them restricted to what they need access to, always at some level fails at the human point. And I just don't see a way around that. So it seems like we need a reboot in the way we have these relationships, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You'd have to, you know, hold the contractor more liable or something in order to force them to take it more seriously.
But you know what the problem with that is, of course, is then it makes the cost of doing contract business maybe out of the reach for a lot of smaller people.
Yep.
That's a tough thing, Alan.
Yep. And yeah, so it comes down to either stop the government using contractors, but then how do you get the expertise? Because like you said, a lot of, you know, IT security experts especially probably don't want to work for the government and have to wear a tie or something like that, you know?
All right.
So it's quite a challenge to really sort it all out.
Yeah, sure is. Sure is. Any other thoughts on that story?
No, not on that one.
All right. Well, you guys can find the full PDF, which has even more details in the report, linked in the show notes over at jupiterbroadcasting.com. Just look for episode 149 of the TechSnap program. And Alan has copiously documented all of it in the with the absolute need-to-knows parts, and then you can get all of it in that PDF. Alan, I want to take a moment to thank Ting.com. Everybody go to techsnap.ting.com. Ting is a sponsor of the TechSnap program, my mobile service provider, and it's mobile that makes sense. It's a no BS mobile service provider, and I really mean that. There's no contracts, no early termination fee, truly and completely contract-free, and you only pay for what you use. Each line starts at a flat $6 per month. That's how much it costs me per month to have this Ting phone, with no contract, no early termination fee. And I pay for my usage on top of that. What's even better is Ting's recently just slashed their data rates, and now the prices are even better than before. And every plan includes hotspot, tethering, caller ID, voicemail, picture messaging. It's all in here, and I'm just paying for my usage. Go get started by going to techsnap.ting.com and try out that savings calculator. Now that Ting just lowered their rates, if you've tried this before, it's worth trying all over again, my friends, because I think you're going to be surprised at what you can save. And by the way, if you're locked into a contract right now, you know, the old school way, Ting also has an early termination relief program. Yeah, they'll help you get out of that ETF. They'll pay up to $75 per line that you have to cancel. Let me tell you something, friends. My first Ting month was like under $20, so that would more than pay for probably 2 months of Ting service if you're just switching over right now, because I've been using Waze a lot and I get more up there. It's around $30 a month. A $30 a month for a full-fledged smartphone plan with hotspot and tethering? Yeah, I'll take that. And it's going to get even better over at Ting. They've got some imminent devices coming to the Ting network. Mm-hmm. Soon you'll be able to bring your own HTC One or Samsung Galaxy S4 if you have that. That'll be coming soon. They're also adding the HTC One Max, which is the really big version of the HTC. And they're going to have the LG Rumor Touch refurbished, so they'll have it at a great price, $40. They're also going to have a Sanyo Miro, which is a feature phone, but it's a really elegant-looking feature phone with a really nice like OLED display for the clock on the front. They got also the LG Flex coming to Ting, which is, have you seen the LG Flex, Alan?
No.
It's like concaved. It's like, it matches the concave of your face, so it's like that It's,
well, I know that my Nexus is
has a slight
like
yep,
that.
Yep, yep. Yeah. It's like that, taken a little bit for nobody's really done it since your Nexus. Well, a couple people have, but now it's back big time.
The problem I have with it is when typing on the screen at the very edge where the concave is the surface, it's really hard to hit the space bar and always
Want
to hit the button above the space bar.
Oh, really? Yeah, yes. I wonder if this...
Half of my typos are typing N instead of space.
I think the curve thing is a trend, but like, I'd totally like to try one of the... I don't know if I'm... I really like my Nexus 5, but I'd
it's
really
supposed
like to
help
try
with
one.
The glare, and it does seem to.
Yeah, in the sunlight, it's supposed to help, in the direct sun, too. And it's supposed to be more comfortable if you talk a lot. I don't know. By the way, the S4 is going to have tri-band LTE, which has been awesome because that's getting rolled out more and more across the Ting network. And that'll give you even more power. When you operate on three distinct bands, tri-band LTE offers broadband coverage at incredible speeds, and you can use it for better signal, for better data. And they got a lot of great stuff coming to Ting, including over on Ting right now, they have an unboxing of the LG G2. You should follow the Ting YouTube account and subscribe because they're doing more unboxings and giveaways. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of these devices show up on that unboxing page. So go to Ting's YouTube page over at youtube.com/, I think it's Ting. And you can subscribe, and then you just leave a comment, and you'll be entered to the giveaway, which is pretty nice. Ooh. Pretty nice. Yeah, there you go. I just subscribed to the Ting page, and you can too. You can also follow them on Twitter, at TingFTW. So go to techsnap.ting.com to get started. Go save yourself some money. Try out that savings calculator with those new rates. And a big thank you to Ting for sponsoring the TechSnap program. Alan, was there anything else we wanted to cover in the news segment?
Nope, that's it for the news.
All right, I want to give a quick plug to the TechSnap subreddit over at techsnap.reddit.com. And by the way, if you're not watching live, you might want to, because before the show, boy, it really is, the encoding didn't hold up too well, but I rode a roller coaster on the live stream, and somebody on the TechSnap subreddit grabbed that on the Q56. He's so quick. He is so quick. And so if you can join us live, if you can't join us live, another part to get involved with the TechSnap program is that TechSnap subreddit, techsnap.reddit.com or links.techsnap.tv. And Alan, with the news all done, that means it's time for the TechSnap feedback. Thanks for sending your emails to techsnap@jupiterbroadcasting.com or popping that contact link at the top of the Jupiter Broadcasting website, or even better, starting a thread in our subreddit at links.techsnap.tv. Like our first question, and it comes from Josamine. I'm going to go with Josamine. He says, what's the best way of archiving terabytes of video? We have a lecture streaming system at the college I work at and go to. I need to archive our older videos so that we have enough space for the coming semesters. Does anyone here know the best way to archive terabytes of video? My current thought is just to make some 3-terabyte hard drives, copy the videos over, and call it a day. Now, isn't this funny? Because we were just talking about this very problem, Alan. Yep. Almost like it was meant to be.
There's a couple of different ways to approach this. It depends, A, how valuable you consider the individual recordings. Like, how bad is it if you lose some? And also, how much you're talking about. When you say terabytes of video, do you mean like single-digit terabytes? Like, there's 4 terabytes? Or are you talking about, like, hundreds of terabytes? And how much do you expect it to grow? And, you know, firstly, depending
some 3-terabyte drive. So I'd say maybe we assume around 6 terabytes or more.
Yeah, we're looking at sub-10 terabytes probably.
Yeah.
Depends on a couple of things. How are the videos encoded? If you switch that to H.264, could you make those videos a lot smaller?
Yeah, he says they're, I think later on in the thread, he mentions their Mastroka file, MKV, MTS files. I'm sorry. So they're MTS files. They may be even completely uncompressed, or at least right from the camera, whatever compression the camera is using. Could be AVC compression.
Right. Now, you know, you may be able to compress those, and that would be good.
Yeah, and likely with very little quality loss, really. You could probably get them down quite a bit.
With H.264 and stuff.
Yeah.
Then for archiving, the problem with doing individual drives is that they can fail, and that, you know, if you're talking about having drives on a shelf, then, you know, you never know when they're going to fail, and you have other problems, like what file system do you use so that you'll be able to read it in the future. And
What about backing them up to a private YouTube channel or archive.org page, something like that?
I definitely wouldn't assume that YouTube's going to keep your videos for you, or that you're going to be able to extract the videos from YouTube in a format that's going to be useful to you.
Yeah, it's true. They re-encode it quite a bit and crunch it down. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, currently you can extract your video, but will you be able to in the future?
Yeah, they don't like that very much.
Exactly. With the problem with archive.org is, you know, they only have so much space and they have rules about what can go on there. And, you know, it doesn't seem right to abuse a charity like that. The advantage to doing something like ZFS is that you're getting the redundancy and the checksumming, right? So you're not going to get a flip bit that's going to corrupt your video or something. And if the videos are uncompressed, you can use ZFS compression to transparently compress them. So they'll make it take up less disk space, mm-hmm. but you'll still have losslessly the original file. And that can make a big difference for when you're dealing with, you know, editing them in the future. One of the advantages of using an open format so that it'll be usable in the future, but uncompressed or whatever, means that you can always, you know, in 5 years from now, we probably won't be using H.264. We'll be using H.265 or WebM or something. So maybe by then there'll be so much better compression that H.264 wouldn't have been the best choice.
Mm-hmm.
You could have got better quality in the same file size if you still had that original, but you don't have that original.
Right.
So if you could save the uncompressed files but compress them with LZ4, then you might be able to get the best of both worlds that way. You get a bunch of compression, but you still have the original lossless data recordings.
Speaking of archive.org, Memnock Proxy in the subreddit points to archive.org's mailing list. He says archive.org is under budgetary tightness, power and bandwidth limitations, and they have an open mailing list you could check out. He also mentions that many campuses have an open access council where extra campus computing resources and planning are discussed. He said you consult with your department head and ask for their recommendations for who they've met on campus and have successfully provided a similar service. This will very likely be a department budget to bill project time, host visit from the IT staff, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe working with other people in the university could be a way to do it. I like Alan's suggestions, and I also like the idea of, yeah, if you really are, if you can only spend maybe like $2,000, $1,500, one nice thing is the Drobo. You could always grab one Drobo at two different locations. The Drobo supports multi-size drives, so when 4 terabyte drives come out, you just slide 4 terabyte drives in there. It dynamically grows the storage pool. You can remove all the Drobo drives and put them in another Drobo. Now, I know it's not a super great solution, but it's straightforward.
The Drobo, you can't put it in something that's not a Drobo. What if there's no Drobos 10 years from now?
Well,
things like that.
I would say
ZFS can do a lot of the same things, right? Like you can do a bunch of 3 terabyte drives,
but I'm thinking,
then you can add to that Z pool a bunch of 6 terabyte drives in the future.
I mean, I think that's fine if they have the resources to do that.
Slowly replace the 3 terabyte drives with 6 terabyte drives, and then the Z pool will snap to the bigger side.
And you could use the FreeNAS Mini as an example to get it like Drobo-like to do that.
Yep. But if you want it as an appliance.
I just, you know, I know a lot of places where they're dealing with audio-visual, and like for them, it's a challenge to even unmount the hard drive from the Mac, right? So this is their level of, whereas like the Drobo is you plug it in, you copy it over. You could buy two, so you have one in each location.
Same thing with the FreeNAS. A lot of other universities use the hardware from IX Systems. They have the TrueNAS, and what it is 2 1U controller computers that then connect to big sleds full of hard drives so that you can just keep adding more drives to this already existing controller units.
Right, so as you just need more storage, you just go out, because if you're
recording every lecture ever, then you're going to have more every month.
You might get a cadence. You might know, this semester we'll burn through 9 terabytes, so we need to, you know, go purchase 9 terabytes worth of drives beforehand.
Right. Before each semester, you'll have a general idea of there's going to be X hours of lectures, and we know that with our compression, we're getting X size for each hour or whatever. And you can do that. And then also in the future, you know, 5 years down the road, you can be, all right, well, these 4 sleds can now be compressed into 1 new sled that'll hold all that data.
And the challenge where that could get expensive
ZFS is that you have the checksumming so that you don't have to worry about individual data getting corrupted.
I think that would work, except for that can get really expensive if he needs to have it in two locations. Like that's what can get expensive
in a Drobo. Like even with the Drobo, you're still down to the solution of, you know, the hard drive still costs the amount of the hard drive.
Yeah. And the Drobo housing's like $600 without any drives.
The Drobo, you're paying for software. With FreeNAS, you're not. With TrueNAS, you are, but it's still.
Yeah. I think the Drobo would be my last choice. But if, you know, depending on the technicality of the users that'll be implementing the solution, the technical ability was going to determine that.
If you fit it all for what you're going to need for the next little while in like a tower, then you can just get two FreeNAS systems and do it that way. But if you're dealing with larger amounts of data and a longer term solution, then looking at a true NAS from IX would be really useful. And also, the nice thing about IX is they can lease the hardware.
Oh, yeah.
So that can make a big difference, you know, when you can have it as an operational cost to store that video. Yep. You know, it's just going to be this much a month instead of having to spend. Hmm. You know, like we were looking at that when we bought our giant storage server from IX that holds like 160 terabytes or something. I forget what that total is. It's
Are you SSHing to it right now?
120 terabytes. So we built a system that holds 120 terabytes. And it's like, well, it's going to cost this much. It's like, well, we can lease it for just, in the end, the total price over the course of 2 or 3 years or whatever comes out to this little bit more. And having that as a monthly cost could be a lot better.
Yeah. And it's, you know, for.
Consider that. And
there's a lot of business reasons to do that.
Having to get two more. Yeah. And there's a lot of business reasons to do that, to defer that cost over time.
Mm-hmm. I might do that. All right.
Yeah.
So Gretchen, I'm not quite sure how we say this next one, writes in about managing SSH keys. Kind of a question we've answered in one form, but it was like 50 episodes ago. So it says, hi, guys. For a few important production BSD servers, login is only possible with a password-protected certificate. I want to move over all servers completely to assert logins, but some management issues are holding me back. Can you tell me some best practices on how to manage all of these keys? How do you guys do this? And thanks for the great show.
So he's using certs already? Because what I was going to recommend when I just saw the title about managing SSH keys is that newer versions of OpenSSH support using a certificate type system so that you can issue certificates from a certificate authority that you control, and then you can have a certificate revocation list so you can
centrally manage
the SSH keys and say, hey, that SSH key isn't valid anymore.
Sounds like what he wants to do is move over all the servers that haven't yet completely moved over to cert logins, but he says he's having management issues that are holding him back. And he wants to know the best practices to manage all of the keys.
There's a couple different ways. I think Michael Lewis has talked in his SSH book about a way to do it with an LDAP system.
Oh.
Which would give you a central way to control the keys.
Did we talk about a DNS-based solution at one time? I seem to remember.
I think so.
Yeah, but I can't
remember. A DNS-based one. But there was one based on SSL certificates, so that you would start your own certificate authority for your company or whatever, and issue the certificates, and they would be used to log in, and then you can, that way you can centrally revoke a certificate and have every box stop respecting that certificate at once.
Trying to find, I know we've talked about it before. I'm searching the site right now. Okay. Red Hat has an article on using several different ways to manage this too, if you check the Red Hat site, and also the Debian Administration Handbook has a bunch of different ways for managing SSH keys. It's Red Hat has one where you use DNS to do it in a certain way. I can't remember what it is though. I was trying to find it. So sounds like it's going to kind of depend on what he needs and what he can implement. I don't know.
So cert login appears to be a specific Oracle thing, maybe, or maybe that's just a name collision.
Yeah, Google is. Yeah, we're both Googling. Yeah, I don't know. Sounds like Alan's recommendation is probably the most straightforward approach. All right,
yeah.
Alan.
So that's something that the OpenSSH project is working on to make it easier.
Yeah, as Hilo points out in the chat room, if you depend on LDAP or DNS, something like that, you're going to be dependent on those core infrastructure services to be up to log into your server, and that's a major thing to consider.
Right. And that's kind of the advantage of doing the SSL type way is that you can have a cache of the certificate revocation list.
Yeah.
So you maybe missed the most recent revocation in an emergency situation or whatever, but in general you know, hey, this list of certificates aren't good anymore. I shouldn't accept these.
Right. All right, well, Alan wrote in, but it's only Alan with a single L. He says, a longtime listener of TechSnap, loved the show last time and many times before. You mentioned island hopping. Can you tell us more about that and how it can be done if computer C does not have access to the internet, but you can get to it through computer A and B? And another scenario, if you break into a Windows box, how can you run commands on a Unix or Linux system? I can't imagine how this could be done, so I hope you understand my question, or if it's easier for you to explain, he concludes some examples, and he linked to several previous tech snaps, 86, 13, 89, and 34, where we've talked about island hopping.
Yeah.
And he also had one more question. Alan has three lands in his house, so could someone island hop due to software vulnerabilities from one land to another? Thanks for the great show.
Okay. So, say you have a business here, and you have computer A, which is, say, the secretary's workstation, and it's on the internet. And then you have computer B, which is, say, where you do the credit card processing, and that doesn't have access to the internet. But the secretary has access to that computer B so that when someone phones up to give a credit card, she can enter it into the system. So if you're coming from the internet, you can't ever get to computer B, but you can get computer A, and once you're on computer A, you can get to computer B. So that would be called island hopping. So you'd, you know, send a phishing email to the secretary and get her to run a Java exploit that now lets you run whatever code you want on her computer. So you install a Trojan that allows you to connect to her computer and control it. Then you can, on that computer, you can download PuTTY or the less interactive version. I think it's called PSSH. It's a command line version of PuTTY for Windows. So it gives you more like the Telnet command line so that when you're running stuff from a command line, it's going back and forth with like a pipe instead of a GUI.
Mm-hmm.
And then with that way, you can set it up so that you can connect to other computers. Or the Trojan can just act as a proxy by making the TCP connection for you and then just relaying the data out.
Yep.
Interesting example, when I was a student in my high school, I wrote a Trojan in Visual Basic 6 because that's what I did in my spare time.
Awesome.
And it had a bunch of different features. It had a limited set of features that I made a control panel for and gave to the teachers. And so they agreed to allow me to install my Trojan on every computer in the school.
Wow.
So the teacher could go and get a list of the computers in their classroom and click on one and see what was on the screen and you know, monitor the students that way. Basic, simple Trojan spyware type thing. What they didn't seem to grasp is that when I built it, I would have built a much bigger control panel with many, many more options for my use. The problem was they had a NAT to get out to the internet, and there's no way for me at home to connect in and control a computer at the school, you know, after school and things like that. So I got them to let me install a server. So I wrote this little server app that got deployed in the math department office, and all the computers in the high school would connect to that server, and then that server would make a backwards tunnel out to my house based on a DynDNS hostname, and then so I could I would run a program, a proxy on my computer, and every computer in the high school would connect to the server at the high school, and the connection between those two would allow me to say, hey, I want to talk to the computer in the math lab, and I'd be able to control it from home.
Awesome.
So that's a little bit of like backwards island hopping.
I would be hired to come in and do penetration testing. So I would have network level access on the LAN, but I wouldn't have any administrative level access. And I had this client who they decided to run their website there at their office, but they had it within a DMZ because it contained credit card information and stuff like that. They wanted to have it protected. And the way you would manage this website, because it had a whole back-end CMS, so that way staff members could put new images on the website and things like new promo packages and stuff like that. Well, they would lock it down by the firewall. They'd say only 192.168.0.25 can access that CMS management page. And I didn't know which machine it was. So through network sniffing, I eventually saw that one computer on the LAN, 0.25, was talking to an IP on the firewall, and I figured out that must be the DMZ IP address. So then using Metasploit and Nessus, I scanned this machine. I found a vulnerability that was on this computer. I think this must have been Windows 7, maybe pre-SP1. Can't remember, it was a little while ago. And Metasploit, once I knew the vulnerability, you go into Metasploit, it's just like a menu of options that you want to throw at a computer. And the one I decided to exploit, it included a VNC server. And so I pushed that out to the machine. It executed the VNC server on the Windows desktop. I got that person's screen, and I was right there at their computer. And then from that computer, I was able to hop to that web server that was otherwise locked down by firewall rules, and then I owned the web server. And so at first I was getting that computer, and then the end result was that web server. And that was a minor version of island hopping. But, you know, we've been talking a lot about this target story, and that's a great example of island hopping.
But the island hopping, you know, none of the computers necessarily have to be exposed to the internet per se, right? Say it's a much more secure company in our island hopping example. The credit card server is on a completely separate network. Like, it's isolated. It doesn't have a network connection at all. It's just standalone by itself. Say it stores something other than just credit cards or something. And the secretary's computer, you can't reach over the internet. But if you can email the secretary a phishing email, and she gets it and clicks it and opens it, you can install the exploit on her computer that, instead of opening a port and waiting for you to connect in, which you won't be able to do because of the firewall, it makes an outbound connection periodically, say, on port 80. So it looks like regular web traffic, except for it's going to a command and control server you have, or an exploited server that you took over from somebody else and are doing something quietly so they won't notice. And now you have this reverse tunnel to be able to access the secretary's computer.
Yeah.
And you install a virus so that every time she plugs in a USB stick, it infects it. So then she takes that USB stick out of her computer and walks over and plugs it into this computer that's not online at all. And now you can exploit that computer, get data off of it, and copy it back to the USB stick. And then she takes the USB stick back to her computer, and then you can offload it and send it to yourself.
I could also picture, you know, if you just infected somebody's computer, and Outlook is such a common target, and every time they wrote an email, it included an attachment. And that attachment was malware, and maybe 1 in 30 people would run that attachment, and then they would become infected, and eventually you'd piece together a network of infected users.
That's how they attacked the Financial Times and The Onion, right? They sent really low-end phishing schemes to everybody at The Onion, or they tried to exclude people in the IT department, but they sent it out. And then one silly person accepted it and ran the virus. Then they used their address book and the email account of the person who got infected to send a much better, more convincing-looking phishing attempt, so that it legitimately came from a person that worked at The Onion. Mm-hmm. So when you get an email with an attachment from someone you know, and it's something you're expecting you might get, you're much more likely to open it than if it's just some random spam off the internet.
And like a lot of times, built-in email client security, if it's somebody in your address book, or in the case of Outlook, if it's somebody in your organization, there's a different set of security policies, like JavaScript in the email might be executed, not anymore, but back in the day, and sometimes still.
Yeah, or just allow attachments versus not.
Yeah. So island hopping can be a lot of things, but it's really just about utilizing an exploit on a lower end device and then using that to then get to a higher end device and then potentially even a higher end device and from there on and there on. And you can do the same thing with privilege escalation. It doesn't have to be physical compromises. It can be you get in with an account that has one certain level of permissions and you use that to either adjust the permissions or get to another account, etc.
Yeah, it just means moving sideways through the network to eventually find a host that you can then do something more on.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, the original, when it's remote attacks, I find, you know, a lot of times, especially in these stories, it's the monitoring systems. It's the HVAC vendor. It's the Nagios box that has firewall.
It's the things people forgot to think about.
Yeah, it could be the syslog server, right? I mean, it's like all this crazy stuff that, yeah, exactly. It's kind of like a set it and forget it appliance that ends up, or print servers, yep. Right? Print servers. We've even seen those HP Gentrex.
In the printer. It's not even a print server. It's just the printer happens to run Linux and bad things happen.
All right. Well, our buddy Kenny has given us an update. Remember he wrote us in about that Dell PowerEdge 1800. He wanted some advice. He says, Alan and Chris, thanks for your advice regarding the Dell PowerEdge server a couple weeks ago. I used as a lab device for my own education, as you suggested. What this brings to light is that with Linux and BSD, we're always alluding to the fact that these OSs can be a lot lighter than others we could mention and therefore can be used to extend the life of older hardware. Ecologically, this would seem to be a good thing, reducing waste, etc. As you hinted in your reply, when is it more environmentally sound to send them to the local recycling depot rather than reconfigure it for continued use? A new version is going to be a hugely more efficient in terms of power consumption and speed will probably be made environmentally friendly materials. It brings into question the idea of recycling old PCs by sticking Ubuntu on them and then sending these out to poor districts, counties, countries, rather than acquiring cheap, modern, low power hardware that will be far more efficient and less use to the poor user in the long run. Great show, as always. The best, Kenny. So, do you make
kind
that
of draw, basic,
draw that line?
I don't actually know some of the numbers of what the power draw of like an old Pentium 4 is versus a newer one. I know the Pentium 4s draw a lot more, but the main difference is the newer stuff has power management features, kind of like a laptop, so that it draws less power when it's not busy.
Yeah.
So like my router is like a new Haswell at like 3 gigahertz or whatever, but it's not running at that speed all the time. It underclocks itself to like 150 megahertz most times because it's not doing much.
I don't really know if I see it as one or other thing like Kenny's suggesting either. Like Kenny could go get himself some fancy Haswell powered machine, which would probably sip power compared to that PowerEdge. And then he could set up that PowerEdge with FreeNAS or Ubuntu and go give it to a school district. Right.
Right. I mean, or if you're comparing the two, you basically look at what's the difference in the power draw. So that's how much power you're going to save, how much that costs multiplied by how long you plan to do it for. And in the end, is it cheaper to buy the new hardware or
usually,
if you keep running the old hardware?
If you're just going on power, it's usually, in my experience, not.
Right. It's like, you know, it's a great way to have an excuse to buy new hardware.
Yeah.
But in general, yeah, for your lab device, you're probably not even going to have it on all the time, maybe. And so
that's where it makes the most sense.
It's perfectly fine.
Yeah, especially in the lab. And, you know, it's probably doing more good for a school than it is in a landfill somewhere. So I think that's always. And, you know, a router, a print server, a simple Samba server, I think we forget how little you can get away with. I mean, I think about what I used to have for my file servers back in the old days. I mean, it's incredible what we now have.
My file server, most of college, was a Duron single core 1 gigahertz.
Duron, yeah, buddy. The Duron.
And it ran hot, and then we stuck it in a closet and closed the door. So
yeah.
It ran really, really hot.
I have one of those here at the house. It runs warm, and I put it in a cabinet. So now it's always warm.
Yeah, we stuck it in like this tiny, it was supposed to be a coat closet, but we never used it as that. It just happened to be
server
where the modem and the switch were wired to all the ports in all the bedrooms in the house that I lived in. So it was a great spot to stick the server, especially later on when, in addition to the cable connection that was provided by the landlord for everybody in the house to share, me and one of my roommates split a DSL connection for gaming, where we'd like, no downloading. If you want to download, use the cable. So we had to set up a way to control that, right? So it's like, if you want to download, have the file server download it for you, and it'll use the cable and have your computer use the DSL.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that way, you're not lagged when you're playing Counter-Strike, but you can download all you need.
Yeah.
Because back then, like, the download speed on our cable was like 5 megabits.
I used to, I didn't even realize what I was doing at the time, but I set up a modem dial-in at the school district when I was a student before I actually worked there. And I would, and they had a T1 at the high school. And that, Alan,
yeah,
a T1.
Oh, I remember the T1 at,
was it like the most epic thing ever?
Yes. Because I still have like 33.6K at home.
Yeah, same.
And I forget what I was downloading, like the ISO image for something.
Yeah.
I forget what it was. Like I was.
Must have been like an old Red
very
Hat.
New. I don't think it was Red Hat. I was fairly new at the whole idea of ISO files,
yeah,
right? Because that wasn't something you dealt with your slow computer. And it was
right.
Like, I think it was the first time I used a CD burner too. It was an external SCSI CD burner.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I had one of those.
The machine was like 400 megahertz that I was using. I forget what it was, but I downloaded the ISO file for something to burn the. I think it was a preview edition of Windows 2000.
Oh, wow.
Soft
tech. Sounds about the right time. You know, I would dial up to the school. Like, I would use them. I had a computer in the lab, which I attached a modem to. And I would dial into that and make it my ISP. And then I would have the computer there queue up all the stuff I wanted downloaded that I'd found over the evening since I'd been home from school. And then I would go to school and, you know, sort through all the stuff that I wanted to keep. But then the problem was, is I had to burn it to CD to take it home. And they only had one CD burner. It's like this whole shell game I had to play back in the day. So,
well, I remember even when I started my shell provider business for doing IRC shell accounts. So I had this machine that had like a 40 megabit connection. It wasn't all dedicated to me, but I had access to it, right? So I'd be like, yeah, so I'll download what I want to that, then download that with my dial-up because it will saturate my dial-up because it's the latency is so much less because it's like one town away, not...
Yep, I would do that too sometimes.
So yeah, I would be able to get like 5.5 kilobytes per second on my 56K connection and just saturate it to the point where you couldn't type in the SSH window.
I used a program called GetRight, I think it was called.
I used GetRight and I could set a speed limit.
Yep.
So I could speed limit it when I needed to use SSH and then turn it back off when I wasn't.
That's totally what I did. That's awesome. GetRight was the bomb.
Yeah. Well, because it also came in handy in college when we had that set up with the two connections, when there was like a big download to do. Like, I think we were downloading the ISO for something for school. It was like a Windows server or something. I forget what it was. Or it might have been Linux for the Linux class. It was like Red Hat 9. GetRight supported multi-segmental downloading where you could give it like four FTP mirrors and it would download.
That's
By using the routing table manually, we could say, use these two mirrors over the cable and these two mirrors over the DSL.
Oh, funny.
And then download, and it's like the first time I ever watched a download go at 1 megabyte per second.
Oh, that must have been amazing.
Because we had DSL that would do, or the cable would do 5 down and the DSL would do 3 down. So that would give us the 8 megabits that you need to get 1 megabyte per second.
Oh, wow.
It was just on the fuzzy edge of being able to roll over and see 1 megabyte per second. You were like, oh my God, it's so fast.
The hoops we had to jump through, Alan.
Yeah. Now I'm like, why is my download doing less than 5 megabytes a second? Grr.
And, you know, our next email, John, he's a little concerned that his ISP might be screwing with him. And I haven't heard about this, so I wonder if the TechSnap audience could confirm John's story here. He says, hi there. He's in Poland, and he says, get this. The Poland ISP is using essentially a man-in-the-middle attack. He says, they're the ISP, so I don't know if you can really call them that, but they block Mozilla and Mozilla add-ons. And the router and DNS boxes get grayed out. So first, here's how it works. When your add-ons become outdated or vulnerable, you hit the Firefox update via the check for updates. Then Orange, the ISP, installs their own version of Firefox, but you must like hijack that connection onto the user's computer. He says, no kidding. It's so seamless that nobody would even notice it. He only noticed it because he happened to be using Fedora, and it downloaded an executable, an EXE, and not the proper version. Mm-hmm. He says, I'd never experienced removal of my config before this, but now, this time, when they installed on his Windows box, it actually wiped out all of his configuration. And then, without his consent, he says, it activated a free Wi-Fi called Orange FunSpot as a second, separate, free, unsecured Wi-Fi network, and it's halved the signal strength of my secured Wi-Fi. Some people have reported they've had their speed lowered by the speed of that free, unsecured second network. It is now not possible to turn it off in the router config, and this option is missing. This is on his router that they've turned this on. And he says it's all...
I know Comcast has been creating an uproar by doing the same thing with the free Wi-Fi to people all over the States.
He says it's all over Poland this is happening.
Yep. So the Firefox thing is a different issue than the Wi-Fi. The Wi-Fi thing, it's like, oftentimes you read the contract, they own the router, it's their router, so they can do that.
This is why I put a pfSense box in front of their...
Yep. I was lucky I have an ISP that doesn't force me to do that. I put their router in bridge mode and it just lets my pfSense do all the work.
Did I tell you that I got them to come out here and now it's Ethernet right to my pfSense box? Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah.
But for the Firefox thing, that's kind of interesting.
That's kind of horrible. Because that's got to be an SSL connection.
Right. I wonder if there's some way he could manually get a newer Firefox that then would.
Well, he says they block Mozilla.org, so I'm assuming that also means the Firefox.
That's fishy.
And he says they block the add-on site, too.
Right. Everything.mozilla.org.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
I haven't heard of this, but I know Orange has got a rep for being jerks, so. I wonder if he used Tor or a VPN.
Or something to get a real, like, I wonder how long it's been going on, because if it goes back far enough, maybe Firefox wasn't doing as much checking back then, but now they have a lot of stuff in there to prevent this type of thing since that behavior started happening.
Yeah.
So if you could get a new version fresh and install it, then it should not automatically update to an illegitimate one that way.
Alan, maybe you can check my time math here, but this only applies to people on the download. Those of you watching live, you still have one more week. But if you're watching the TechSnap the week this was released for download, be sure you join us live on Sunday for Linux Action Show episode 300 at 10 a.m. Pacific, which I have written down as 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. UTC.
Yes.
I got it. Good for me. It should be a big show, and just going to be fun to catch up and let everybody know about our plans for 2014 for the Linux Action Show. So cool. I encourage you to join us for that. Episode 300. We got some fun stuff to announce. All right, Alan. Well, with the feedback all done, that means it's time for the TechSnap Roundup. Welcome to the TechSnap Roundup. Yeah, that's what that crazy music means. Now, the Roundup for stories, it just didn't quite fit at the top of the show, but we still want to talk about them, give you some links to follow up on your own after the show. And a lot of these links came from our subreddit over at links.techsnap.tv. And Alan, our first one's a Sony story. We haven't talked about Sony in anything but sort of horrible context for a while. Sony is selling off their VAIO PC business in what some are calling a trend of the times, Alan. Also, because, you know, other people are selling off their PC business. But a lot of people like the VAIO laptops. But due to ongoing financial struggles, Sony is set to sell off its Vio PC business in order to focus on smartphones and tablets. The company said it'll also try to regain its redouble on its TV efforts with an eye on 4K. I just thought it was interesting. I know a lot of folks out there like the Vios, so interesting little note in the tech history. I've never been a big fan.
You know, a lot of people buy tablets and stuff, but I don't see tablets really overtaking PCs. Like,
you know,
a lot of these businesses seems to be betting on it, and other people are like, yeah, sure, we'll buy your PC business cheap because PCs make money.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like maybe tablets will become a more high volume, and then PCs will get replaced a little less than they have before because they're getting pretty good now.
There's very few times when you could do everything you would need to do on the PC with a tablet.
Right.
I think most people that have a tablet have it as a second device.
Yep.
They use it for some things.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop anybody from having a PC.
I think the problem is
replacement cycle on PCs is much slower now.
Right. I mean, like, now you're getting to the point where, you know, you get an i7 box or an i5 box, and that could last you for, especially for a lot of users, you know, 5 years.
Yeah, I have an i7 that's been going for, like, 3 years now.
Yeah. Yeah, the machine I'm Skyping to you on right now is the same thing. And whereas a tablet, those things are, you know, the battery craps out in 2 years. The ARM processor is barely doing what you need to do right now. So the replacement is a lot more, so there's just a higher volume there, I think, is what it is. All right.
And I think that's part of it. The sales numbers are kind of lie sometimes when you see all these sales. It's like, yeah, but it's the percentage of people that have them is smaller than what the sales numbers look like
because
it's the same people just buying, replacing theirs over and over again because they
like
the idea with these, of the gadget.
With these Chromebook sales right now, you know, like these Chromebooks are selling like crazy. Well, it's because you can get a Chromebook for $200. So if your laptop or your PC is doing like most of what you need, but maybe the battery's a little shitty or something like that, you just go buy a Chromebook and that'll last you another 2 years and then you get a full
new
PC.
Or you've seen people buy a Chromebook, find out it's not as great as they thought, and then have to replace it in a short amount of time.
There's that.
Like they'll use it for like 4 months or something and then be like, oh.
Yeah.
I see why this was only $200.
Yeah.
A lot of people are tight on cash and are trying to get by using something less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with the economy the way it is. All right, let's talk a little bit about where digital secrets go to die. What's this about?
Yes, this is an article over on govtech.com.
Oh, frequent there, do you?
No. but it's about a service that destroys machines for the government. It's the E-End Secure Data Sanitization and Electronics Recycling.
Huh. Catchy.
The clients include the Department of Defense and other federal agencies. Its work is to destroy hard drives, computers, monitors, and phones and other sensitive equipment that government and corporations don't want to get into the wrong hands. The monitors, I have some questions about. It's like, I suppose you might be able to see what was on the screen, the very end or something, or if something got burned in, but most often, I think you could recycle the screens without having to destroy them. But some places just have policies that say everything must be destroyed.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just that. What do they call it? Abundance of caution?
Something like that.
Yeah.
With high-profile information leaks from the NSA and so on, and we've seen case after case of hospitals and stuff selling their old PCs on eBay with the health records still on them and stuff. Apparently, E-End has an annual revenue in excess of $1 million. The company employs 16 people, all of whom have gone through background checks. But need to destroy a rugged Toughbook laptop that might have been used in a war? E-End will use high-powered magnetic process known as degaussing to erase the hard drive of any memory. The computer monitor that might have displayed top-secret images crushed and ground into recyclable glass.
Really?
Laser sights for weapon torn into tiny shreds of metal. I can see why you'd have to destroy the laser sights. Although they seem like they'd be reused for other purposes. But I guess the point is they don't want to be reused by other people.
Yeah. A little bit of both.
Yes. E-End adheres to the government's highest demilitarization standards and NSA guidelines and document every step of the data sanitization program with photographs and paperwork. So they actually have to prove that they destroyed the hard drive. Although taking a picture doesn't necessarily prove all that much, but
that's true. You know, did you see? Did we put it in the? Maybe I shouldn't say anything because I think I might
forget. There was one. I forget.
I didn't put it in the roundup. Dang it!
I forget which program I saw it on, but I know that the British MI5, I think it was, grinds up the hard drives into like a powder.
Yeah.
Puts it in a tiny box and keeps the tiny box in a safe.
that's excessive. Okay. Yeah. They're just collecting at that point. They're just collecting.
Well, somebody's got a nice contract to store sand.
Yeah. 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 Basically. Yeah. Dirty. Yeah. All right. Should we go to the next story?
The company has contracts with the DC National Guard, the Secret Service, L3 Communications, which is not to be confused with Level 3, the ISP, right. But L3 makes optics and stuff for tanks and Bradleys and fighting vehicles and stuff.
Oh, okay.
I have a friend that works at their office here in Canada. He's background checks and stuff, fun stuff. They said they actually shred the drives while you watch and provide a certificate sheet after the process.
Oh, I like that.
So
part.
If you remember that video we saw from Google, where they like erase the drive and then they stick it in the machine, and, like punch a hole in it, and then grind it up into metal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they do that, and they say they also do like healthcare insurers and providers, and you know anybody that's worried about making sure their data doesn't get anywhere.
Kind of sounds like a fun industry to be in a little bit. Like so, you know, they just made a business out of that. Destroying
Ian's
machines.
Zero landfill policy fits the hospital's goal to seek green options and to protect their data.
All right. Now, next story.
Yep.
So this next one sort of fits in with the Vio story. Just kind of puts it in perspective. This is a little bit that came out just recently from an interview with the former president of Sony. He says, most of Sony's executives spend their winter vacation in Hawaii and play golf after celebrating the new year. In one of those New Year golf competitions back in 2001, Steve Jobs and other Apple executives were waiting for us at the end of the golf course, he said, holding a Vio running Mac OS. This is from the former Sony president at the time. He said, 2001 is the year and Mac OS X shipped, and he says, I was speculating that it was an Intel version of Mac OS X that they had had. He said he liked Apple and always felt that the Mac and Vio were close in philosophy. However, he said no thank you about, and Steve Jobs approached him about shipping Mac OS X as certified Mac units on Vios. But Vio had just recently completed hardware and software optimization specifically for the Windows platform and felt like it was going to be awesome. And because of this, the team said no thank you, and most of the engineering team said it wasn't worth it. And that was the end of the Mac-compatible Vio back in 2001. So now here we are. Sony is selling the Vio division, and now Apple has...
Because it's not profitable enough.
Apple has 19.5% of the global PC and tablet share, now larger than Dell and HP combined.
Mm.
So I think they would have made some. They would have sold some Vios.
I do wonder if they had a deal with Microsoft that said that they couldn't.
Maybe. I mean, the Vios were really sweet machines, and they were those tiny ones back then, too.
Yeah.
And Microsoft was kind of famous for making those kinds of deals.
It's kind of strange that Apple didn't find someone else to do that with. But, you know, I guess HP and Dell probably were already in bed with Microsoft, so they kind of... It would have been interesting to see how different things might be if Sony had said yes.
Yeah. This next link is a video from the AT&T archives, the Unix system making computers more productive. Alan, I just got to play a little clip of it.
Yeah. If you start about 5.5 minutes in, there's a really good bit about how shell and pipes work.
Okay. The usual way to get a large computer application developed.
Right here.
And programs that you write yourself. And what you can do is to think of the Unix system programs, basically, as in some sense the building blocks with which you can create things. And the thing that distinguishes Unix system from many other systems is the degree to which those building blocks can be glued together in a variety of different ways, not just obvious ways, but in many cases very unobvious ways, to get different jobs done. The system is very flexible in that respect. I think the notion of pipelining is the fundamental contribution. If the system is, you can take a bunch of programs, two or more programs, and stick them together end to end so that the data simply flows from the one on the left to the one on the right. And the system itself looks after all of the connections, all of the synchronization, making sure that the data goes from the one into the other. The programs themselves don't know anything about the connection. As far as they're concerned, they're just talking to the terminal. But let me give you an example.
So it goes on for a couple of minutes, but he writes this short little like email or something, right? And he's got typos in it or whatever. And then he pipes it through the first program, which breaks it down into the individual words, right? So it's got one word per line. And then he pipes that through a program that lowercases everything. So that because his dictionary that he wants to do the spell check with is all lowercase. and then he can pipe it through sort. So his words are in alphabetical order, the same order they would be in the dictionary, and then pipe it through unique to make it so that it only has, there's no duplicate words. And then he can pipe it through his spell checker.
This video was shot in 1982, the description says.
Yep.
Wow. I mean, what's crazy about it is actually it's very relevant still.
Yeah. Well, it just goes to show the power of Unix and the philosophy of a bunch of small tools that don't have a specific use necessarily. They're just things you can do. And by chaining a bunch of them together, you can create something.
Yeah.
And
it's a beautiful system.
This is still very popular in Japan, like large CRMs and stuff that now would be, you know, giant honking Java application with a huge Oracle database or something, are still built Unix like this. They're flat text files, and then they go through like 8 pipes, and they come out with what you're looking for. I think we linked to a talk about it before, but I will I'll find a link and add it to the show notes as well.
Here's one where they're explaining the file hierarchy.
Let me go back down to BWK, and
this is
English
great.
Means print the name of my working directory, and it'll tell me where I am. It says at the moment that I'm in user BWK. That's where I start when I log in. Now, I can go up a level in that. I can change to parent level. And now, if I print my working directory, I'm in / user.
His keyboard kind of sounds like yours, Alan.
To the root of the whole file system. Let me go back down to BWK. And I can list the files that I have in that directory. And I find there, among other things, a directory called TV. And I can list the files that are there, and I'll find, among other things, the sentence that we printed in the spelling mistake finding program. Let me look at that, and sure enough, there it is.
This
is
so great.
So you can see the file system hierarchy makes it possible for users to organize information into its natural grouping and to go up or down and find things quickly and easily. The Unix system interface for most people is through a program called the shell or the command interpreter. And basically,
so it's a 27-minute video, and we'll have it linked in the roundup.
Yep.
You got to watch this, you guys. This is a really good find, and it was also linked in the TechSnap subreddit too.
Yep.
Kind of amazing that you, over Skype from Canada, have better video quality than this professional production back in 1982.
Oh, the very start of the video, the long pauses, all the guys like trying to grok the teleprompter or whatever he was using. It's like, wow, this is definitely an early 80s video of
the usual
computer
way to get
geeks.
A large computer application developed involves
pause.
A big team of people working in close coordination.
Pause.
Most of the time this
That's so great. That's so great. Okay.
Yeah. It's right. A very small buffer.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, we did link to this. I don't know why I didn't see this when I was talking about it. We were talking about data destruction. I have linked in the show notes an article The Verge ran where you can watch The Guardian destroy the Snowden leak hard drives with power tools. So I don't know if you guys remember, but the government pressured the journalists at The Guardian to actually physically destroy the hard drives on their computers. So,
well, by the look of it, the entire laptops.
Yeah.
Like they have motherboards and stuff, and they're drilling random holes in them and stuff.
Yeah, on Saturday, July 20th, in the basement of the Guardian's London office, under the watchful eye of 2 GCHQ technicians, 3 Guardian editors destroyed the hard drives, memory cards, which the encrypted files leaked by Edward Snowden.
It's that it was the Prime Minister who instructed Britain's most senior...
I don't want to play that. BBC is so pull-down happy. So here they are. That's them destroying the MacBook. That's the SSD.
Pressure in which the cabinet...
So if you guys want to watch a little destruction porn, speaking of hardware destruction, that's so Orwellian to make them just sit there and watch them destroy the computers. And like, what digital backups of it exist?
Yeah, it's not like I understand they don't want the copies falling in anybody else's hands, but it's like they think they're acting like it's
like the only copy of it or something.
Yeah, like this is getting rid of the.
Meanwhile, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and ProPublica all have copies of it. Plus, Glenn Greenwald. Has copies of everything. So what are you solving?
And he took them somewhere where the GCHQ can't reach him.
Well, it sounds like the Canadian equivalent of the NSA has kind of been checking out what the NSA is doing, thinking, hey, you know that user metadata collection?
Well, I think this is older, so it came out based on the Snowden documents.
I'm making a phone.
That the CSEC used the Wi-Fi points in airports to track MAC addresses and figure out where people were going. Or where they went and how long they stayed and things like that. So you say, oh, we saw this MAC address appear at this airport and then at this airport. So we know that person went from there to there.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're at the airport on this date when they came into the country, and then we saw them again on the way out.
We on Filter 84, we covered there's been three responses now, and now the current response. And what do you think, Alan? It sounds like the response we get here is, well, guys, it's just metadata. I love that.
Well, mostly what I saw is that if you actually read the PDF, it says we tried this and found that it's too slow and wouldn't actually work.
It sounds like it was like an experiment to see if they could do it.
But it sounds like it only ran for 2 weeks and they were just trying it to see if it was a useful way to track a terrorist.
That, however,
they said that it's too slow.
That's just one of three explanations they gave us back. So do you think that's what it is? Or do you think it's an ongoing thing?
So I agree, like what the thing says, that they tried it and it didn't work.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to turn it off. Why would you not record more data when you could record
more
data?
That's what I was thinking too, yeah. Okay.
But then, if they're only doing it in the airport, then they can't get all that much data. Now, if they're doing it all over the place, then they can get all kinds of data about where you are all the time.
Well, yeah.
My phone's Wi-Fi option is turned off, except for when I want it, mostly to save the battery, honestly. But
Yeah, it just seems like a good idea when you're traveling, regardless of where you're traveling.
Yep.
All right, well, this number might screw with your head a little bit. China has almost twice as many internet users as the U.S. has people. The China Internet Network Information Center reported that the country has nearly 618 million internet users earlier this month. That is nearly twice as many people online. That's nearly twice as many people online in China as there are people in the United States in total. 500 million of those users in China are actually mobile web users as well, which is pretty nuts. But
that means they have phones and not computers.
Yeah. But those 618 million Chinese internet users account for less than half of the country's total population, whereas the most recent Pew Internet and American Life Project research showed that 85% of Americans use the internet.
Mm-hmm. And most of them have access to it from more than just their phone.
Yeah. I think a lot of people...
But in a lot of the places in the developing world, the phone is their only connection to the internet.
Well, we were talking last week about pin and chip technology and credit cards and how the U.S. sort of had the first comer's disadvantage. And a lot of people might leapfrog wired infrastructure in a lot of sense and go straight to LTE and those kinds of things in mobile. It could be...
Yeah, although with LTE, you still can't carry quite as much data.
Yeah.
But, in India... paying for stuff with your cell phone is more common than having a credit card.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
it's almost all stored value type stuff rather than credit.
The payment traffic there is insane. The numbers are just totally blow my mind every time I hear them. I can't remember what they are off the top of my head, but it's an incredible.
Well, it's a lot of very small transactions, but
yeah. All right. This next one's kind of a bummer. Hackers steal Western Michigan University's professor's paycheck.
So apparently the hackers broke into the university's HR website, which apparently just has a username and password, and you can log in. And they changed his direct deposit details so that his paycheck would be deposited to a bank in Utah instead. And then they took all the money out of that, leaving the account with $13 in it. And that's all he got back out of his paycheck.
Oh, man.
Now, he's trying to say it's the university's fault because it was the university that got hacked, but it was his account. And so it's... But apparently he wasn't the only person that it happened to at the university. And so the university has given him an early paycheck. What do they call that?
Not a stipend.
It's in the article, anyway.
Yeah.
Like
an advance or whatever.
An advance on his paycheck and that he'll pay off over his next four paychecks.
Wow, that sucks.
At this point, nobody's really decided what happened there.
Wow, that sucks.
It seems like this type of system shouldn't be online. Most times to change HR things like that, at the school where I worked, you had to submit a bunch of paperwork. But I guess even then, you could probably fake that. I could have changed somebody else's thing if I knew their employee number and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that's pretty rough, though. I mean, if they are responsible... for security lapses.
And if you are going to have an online thing like this, I think that before a change like that goes through, if you fill it out online, it should be a change request, and then somebody should call you and verify, maybe?
Yeah, for pay, that would seem reasonable. Have it flag the HR lady so she can check into it or something. That seems reasonable to me for pay. Next story. Tim Berners-Lee is calling for something that I wholeheartedly agree with. He was speaking with Wired editor David Rowan at an event launching the magazine's March issue. Tim Berners-Lee said that we need to decentralize the web, and that although part of this is about keeping an eye on for-profit internet monopolies such as search engines and social networks, the greatest danger is the emergence of a balkanized web. I want a web that's open, he said, works internationally, works well as possible, and is non-nation-based, Berners told the audience. You know, a lot of the Latin American states are countries are talking about setting up things to avoid, like Brazil, for example, right? It's talking about setting up ways to avoid America's infrastructures altogether, essentially creating a balkanized internet.
Right, but except for a couple of companies that might have a mirror, like Google will have a data center in Brazil or whatever, how are they going to get to any websites in the States? I mean, obviously, they still have to go, but I understand wanting it so that if you're in Brazil and you're trying to go to a website in the UK, that you don't go through the States to get there.
Yeah.
Which almost all traffic does now.
Yeah.
Because, well, if you're in Brazil, your other option is either somehow having a direct cable between Brazil and the UK, or jumping over to Africa somewhere and then across, and then you have a whole different set of problems as far as, well, A, your pipe's only so big, right, where there's a lot more diverse fiber going through the States.
Yep.
And diverse routes and stuff.
Yeah.
And also, it's more politically stable, depending on your definition of politically stable now. But, you know, the government's not going to be overthrown in the States and decide to cut your cable or try to charge you a bunch of money to keep the cable there or something.
Right. Yeah, that internet in the States is backed by drones, Alan, and don't you forget it. Mm. Yeah, the problem is...
And keep your drones on your side of your borders, and don't you forget it.
Oh, we've been having a problem with that recently? Sorry about that.
No, remember a couple weeks back?
Yeah.
One tried to fly across the lake and mysteriously got shot down?
Weird. It does seem to be, though, that if people are worried about security, they're going to want to avoid the U.S. Well, because it doesn't really matter where you're at, because we have agreements with all agencies around the world.
But a lot, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't mean to exaggerate, but yeah, most of the ones that are big and relevant... I just don't want to see, like, the internet be sort of walled off in different areas of the world. That would be such that'd be such a bad long-term consequence of all of this. Okay, well, you know what I think is BS? Big data.
Do you see the picture for this? It's an awesome picture.
Data laughing there. Yeah, yes. Big data. I get it. He's huge. That's very funny.
So, you know, there's been all this talk about big data and people talking about it. It's like, you know, your data's not big if it can fit on a hard drive. Or even a couple of hard drives. You know, it's only big data if you're talking about like massive amounts of information. And he said his example, though, is when LinkedIn had that password leak, right? And they leaked millions and millions of SHA-1 hashes of passwords, 6.5 million accounts, right? And they just had their plain SHA-1 hashes, right? And so sites started setting up things where you could search to see if your password was compromised. Right, you type in your password, it would SHA-1 hash it, and then see if it was in the list. But a bunch of these sites would have all these errors all the time, right? Because they were under heavy load, and the database couldn't keep up. Right, so this guy looked at it and he's like, "Well, the whole database—if you just stored it as text instead of as, you know, an SQL database—it's only 130 megabytes of data." You know, he's like, "I have Chrome tabs that use more memory than that."
No kidding.
Right. So then he was watching on Stack Overflow. There was questions about, you know, how can I check if this hash exists in my database? And, you know, the guy was trying to use MySQL, and then the people were saying, well, yeah, if you tune your MySQL like this, or if you use Couchbase or, you know, Redis and a bunch of other stuff, then maybe you can make it work. But at the same time, this guy wrote something in Go or in C, if you want, that just loads the 130 megabyte data set into RAM and looks it up instantly.
Boom!
And it can handle like thousands and thousands of queries a second without bogging down, where an SQL database is just overcomplicated for this solution.
Yeah. That's part of what it is, isn't it?
So like his whole program here is like a couple of lines of code. It's like import these libraries. You know, each hash is 32 bytes. Listen on this port. Here's a whole function for reading the file into RAM. Here's a function that creates a web server that says, hey, when there's a request for a hash, does it exist? Return 204. Doesn't exist, return 410. Then that's it. That's the whole program. And you can ping this via basically a simple HTTP API and just bam, 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 bam.
Is big data just a way for people to make big money?
Sometimes. Big data is a hard problem to solve if the data is actually big. But if it's, you know, a couple million SHA-256 hashes, like in the example he uses after the LinkedIn example, that's not big data. You know, that's a couple hundred megabytes of, or maybe at most it's 1.5 gigabytes of RAM.
Yeah, that's not big data.
That's not big data.
If it fits on your laptop's SSD, that's not big data.
Exactly.
Yeah. If it fits comfortably in your computer's RAM, it's not big data. Yep. Tell me your thoughts on this next story. Intel likely to sell tablet chips at or below cost to just kind of break into the tablet market. You know, this is something they're getting their butts kicked by ARM. And we just recently talked about the high volume of tablet sales. You worry about this kind of stuff, you know, from a server admin standpoint, that Intel might be getting distracted, maybe losing focus a little bit?
I don't think so. You know, they're still
working hard
on the server stuff. They're working hard on the server stuff.
And they're big,
and
right?
It's different. It's probably not even the same team that's working on this other stuff.
Probably not even the same
country. And I don't think they're going to... They wouldn't want to let their market share in the server area slip.
Right.
Although I can see them working on ARM-style stuff for servers as well. They're doing that with their Atom stuff.
Yeah. I kind of look at it... I don't know if... I know there's maybe architectural things about x86 people don't like, and the power draw is high right now, but I think one of the biggest disadvantages to like tablets themselves is that they can't execute all of the x86-based stuff that I have. And some of the management tools I have are x86-based or require something that is only on the x86 platform.
There's just so much more you can do if it's x86. There's a reason why Mac switched to it.
Yeah, it's really just more versatile and useful for me. Now, of course, there's looks like at this point there's a whole trade-off side to it, but maybe Intel's going to close that gap.
But, you know, someday being able to have a tablet that's just x86 and I could just run whatever I wanted on it would be... Amazeballs.
And the Surface Pro doesn't count because you can't run whatever you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I'm just saying, like, a lower power... Well, Atoms probably could almost do it now. It's just nobody wants to build the slightly more expensive tablet.
Remember,
and so if Intel's willing to trade their profit for market share, then maybe they can make something out of it.
They can afford to do it. Yep. They made a bank off the i-series of processors for a while now.
Yep.
All right, we have a link, the last link in the roundup, encryption failure modes, and we got a great handy graphic here.
There's a couple, actually, in this set.
Oh,
So the first one shows what happens when you use encryption wrong, right? So if you use electronic codebook mode, then you can see the picture of Tux comes out. You can still tell what the picture was. You're not getting the original information back, but you can still tell what it was. Mm-hmm. Or if you use CTR mode, but use the same key and the same... starting random factor. If you encrypt, say, the top of the penguin and the bottom of the penguin separate times, but with the same key and the same mode and everything, then if you do an exclusive OR of the two encrypted versions, you get not the original, but some information about what was in both of those things, because you can tell from the differences, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you use CBC mode or cipher block chaining mode, if you're encrypting the same thing twice with the same initialization vector and the same key, then the data will be exactly the same up until the first difference. So you see in the picture here, we have Tux's eyes are different.
Yep.
So all of the picture up until the first difference is the same, right? Because in cipher block chaining, you encrypt the first block with the key and the initialization vector. Then the second block is encrypted with the hash of the previous block, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're chained together. So that if the same thing appears twice in the same file, that it'll be different. But if you use the same key and same initialization vector, then the same file will come out the same every time.
Right.
Which might not be what you want.
Right.
And so it shows that. So an interesting one that applies recently, if you go to the previous picture, they encrypted the Adobe logo using Triple DES in electronic codebook mode, which is how Adobe encrypted the passwords in their database. And you can still very clearly tell that that's the Adobe logo.
Yeah, absolutely you can.
Yeah. And then I don't have the details on the other stuff, but apparently they wrote this little Python script where they can encrypt a specially crafted PDF file of a picture of Angela Merkel, and the encrypted version comes out as a picture, as a valid PDF file.
This is so funny. These guys have a real good sense of humor. They got one with the RSA, and then it equals NSA.
Yeah, so in this one, they can take an RSA, a PNG image, after encrypting it, the output is still a valid PNG image.
Yeah. This is good. This is good. Adobe equals troll.
Yeah. So, you know, that goes to show there might be some weaknesses there in AES. Mm-hmm. Which is, I'm glad that systems like Gelly and so on support things like Camellia and other ciphers like Blowfish.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. That's our whole show right there. Episode 149 in the can. Next up will be 150. And we'd love to have you join us live for 150. Just go over to jblive.tv at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is
4 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC.
Yep, we'll be back live next week. And don't forget, we have LAS on Sunday, LAS 300 at 10 a.m. Pacific. Love to have you join us live for that. And also email this show. We need your questions. We need more feedback. So go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com, click the contact link, and then choose TechSnap from the drop-down. Please do that. And also check out our subreddit at links.techsnap.tv. You can start threads there as well, especially if you want a really fast response, because we've got a really smart community over there. So there you go, Alan. Well, good luck with the dental stuff. And yep. We'll see you live in a couple of weeks. And don't forget, if you ever wonder when the TechSnap program is out, you can just download it when it is released via any of the number of subscription options we have in every single episode of TechSnap. Just right there, right below the show description, we have the download links, and we have the RSS feed links for torrents and HD and audio. Grab those, subscribe, and then get every single of TechSnap auto-magically. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for tuning in this week's episode of TechSnap. We'll see you right back here next week.